Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKeon welcoming you to Nature's Talk Show, and tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. I am joined by Ken Borman, and Ken and I are going to take you once again on another adventure back in the time. But before we go back and visit the Western Interior Seaway of the Cretaceous period, Ken and I would like to please invite you to go to www.naturestalkshow.com, get into our live chat room there. Ken's in there to field questions from you or comments, et cetera, as we talk about this really amazing part of the Cretaceous period. So without further ado, hello, Ken. How are you doing this evening?
I'm very well, thank you, Ken. Yourself tonight?
Tonight's subject, we're going to talk about the Great Western Interior Seaway.
Excellent. This proves to be it's going to be a great show, I think.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting area, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of fascinating when you think about it. You know that North America, back during the days of the dinosaurs, you know that it was actually split up into several parts by a transgressive sea. An ice-free Earth, you know, there was tectonic events going on that helped the sea cover the continents, North American continent, and plus several other areas too across the world were covered. But of course, no land is ever completely covered because there's not enough water in the world to do that. So, but we see that this was broken up into several areas, and the life that lived in this seaway, Ken, I find it just absolutely fascinating.
It's quite amazing, isn't it, when you think about it. I was just looking at one of the old maps today from the period of time we're going to talk about, and you actually had beachfront property where you are now.
Had what?
Beachfront property.
That I did. For our listeners, if you've ever come across a map showing the Great Western Seaway splitting up Laramedia from Appalachia, if you look at the state of New Mexico outline, Albuquerque, New Mexico is about two-thirds of the way across the state and in from the top to bottom, about two-thirds up, and it's right in the center of the state from east to west. So just right there, right, just barely offshore. If I go, Ken, if I go to the western part of the state, I'm inland. As a matter of fact, if I drive about 30, 40 miles west of where I'm living right now, I'm hitting in the beach. Because right here where I was at in particular was probably about 100 feet of water.
Right. And where I am, of course, too, is I'm in southwestern Ontario for all our listeners, just an hour east of Detroit. I was in the center of Appalachia.
Yeah.
Of course, the Great Lakes weren't there yet. So I was probably on an upland somewhere at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, when we look where you're at, you were probably several hundred kilometers inland from the Hudson Seaway. That was part of the Western Interior Seaway. And also, now when we look at one of our show owner and Mary Fetters, where she lives in Missouri. When you look at the northern part of Missouri along the border of it in Kansas, she was probably about half the distance that you are from the seaway, but I was right there at the edge. And when I, for our listeners out there, I have the opportunity, I've been a research associate of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science for about 6 years now. No, actually about 9 years. And I get to explore all of this this area. So since I've been a member of the museum, I've actually done a whole lot of exploring of our part of the Western Interior Seaway here, Ken. And we're along the eastern shore of Laramedia, along the southern part of it. And I've got to see some amazing fossils in our part of the Western Seaway.
Excellent. And what have you found there, Ken, from this period we're talking about? Cretaceous, isn't it?
The Upper Cretaceous, actually. I think it started down in, let's see here if we can see, the Middle to Late Cretaceous, then part of the very early Paleogene. Then the we start seeing where the water started regressing. But when we start looking at the, I guess you can say, the Albian Age and getting into the Cenomanian, that's when the sea started coming through. And now when we look here in New Mexico deposits, Ken, we see we have the lowermost deposits that we have of this evidence of this here is called the Dakota Sandstone. And what the Dakota Sandstone is as the sea transgressed across, we had the beach. And so we get this sandstone that goes and moves from south to north, these beach sands all the way up and through the North American continent as the seaway progressed and eventually covered this part of the world.
Excellent. Actually, Ken, I've got a request from a question from the chat room for you.
Thank you. Cool.
When they talk about the sea being shallow, how deep do you mean? What is the shallow sea from in the Cretaceous period?
Well, at its deepest, we're talking approximately 760 meters deep.
That's not too far.
Yeah, so see, that's not that deep. That's what they mean by being fairly shallow. You know, most of the times that the seaways have covered the continent, they're not the abyssal type seaways, or the offshore that we see off the continental continental plates.
So I assume that too, that 760 meters you just said, that would be like in the center, or roughly in the center of the seaway too, like, and it would be a gradual slope up to the land areas, I guess.
Basically, that's what it is. You know, this is it's not like an ocean at all. You know, it some parts were shallower than others. At the deepest, it was around 760 meters. Now, because of the way it was, I guess you could say the water flow, et cetera, like that. It was the water was columned, and when we look at the lower part of it, it appears to have been fairly anoxic. When we look at the shales, one of the big deposits we have of the Western Interior Seaway here, and we've collected it in several different areas, is the Mancos Shale. And it is organic rich. As a matter of fact, some of the deposits have a lot of sulfur working out because of the sulfur bacteria that lived in these anoxic areas. So that's one of the ways we can see and know that this was fairly anoxic. Now, one of the interesting things, Ken, is one of these areas that I've collected fossils from. One particular layer of shale that we split open, it was kind of fascinating because it had... I can't think of that very first, the Phragmocone, I think it's called. And there was just thousands of these little tiny, maybe a millimeter in diameter, Phragmocones of ammonites, just littering the shale.
Wow.
I only noticed them because I happened to take sections of that shale and put it under my dissecting microscope. They were cool.
Wow. That's very interesting, actually, that you can find something that small still there from then.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, speaking of ammonites, I read a really cool book that would be interesting, I think, for our listeners. There's a book out there called The Ammonites and Other Cephalopods of the Pierre Seaway. Now, the Pierre Seaway, I believe, is just another name the name of a section of the inland sea, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. This was written by Neil Larson from the Black Hills Institute. Larson family, of course, is famous for digging up Sue and then having that big battle over her. But it's a great book, 148 pages. I haven't got it in my bookstore at the moment. I have had it in the past, and I've read it. I've got it in my collection. So if you can find that, look on Amazon, wherever, or in your local bookstore, if you can find that, Ammonites and Other Cephalopods of the PSCY. It's a great read.
And, well, this one's cool. The CUA itself is a great place to collect these ammonites. Now, one of the interesting things about the ammonite fossils, Ken, is a lot of them are short-range species. And they're very, very good as index fossils here in the Western Interior Seaway. They've left a very, very good evolutionary record in the way of their shells.
Excellent. So you can date an area where you're collecting from the evidence of these fossils.
Yes, the ammonites cover. They're very good for doing that. Some of them only have a period of just maybe a couple, 3-4 million years. The index fossil types. Some of them have a little bit longer temporal range, but for the most part, a lot of these different ammonite species. Now, there's some interesting things about these ammonites too. We see some species that are real thin and narrow. The shells, when you look at them from from end to end. And those ammonites appear to have been able to move through the water at a fairly good rate. Now, we have other ammonites that have big knobs on them and big old gnarly whorls and stuff. And ridges. Yeah, I've got we found those too. We find these here, and we find the narrow ones too, the streamlined ones. So it's really fascinating. A lot of times, when we're in an area, this is kind of cool too, is it'll be dominated by one type of ammonite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it appears, and I think there's still a lot of studies going on about these animals. You know, they're since they're a cephalopod, we know that, you know, the coiled shell with the chambers, et cetera. But one of the things now I think that set the nautiloids off the ammonoids off from the nautiloids. I don't know where I've talked about this on our paleontology show or not, Ken, but I have talked about this on the Nautilus Files when we've had Greg Berard on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big evolutionary change that happened with the ammonites was in their reproduction. Because when we talk about the reproduction of a nautiloid, and there are nautiloid fossils that can be found in the Western Interior Seaway, by the way, for our listeners out there, can find them, mm-hmm. Nautilus species, very close to the nautilus species we have living today, as a matter of fact. But the main thing we see is that nautiluses lay just a teeny tiny handful of eggs per year at best, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
right.
Two or three at best, you know. And these eggs take about a year to hatch. I think the break now, when we look at modern octopi and squid, these suckers lay hundreds of eggs, right?
Right.
Yeah, you know they're. And I think what happened because it's pretty much hypothesized that octopuses are probably shellless or descended from the ammonites. I think what happened back in the Paleozoic is the lineage that led to the ammonites was their evolutionary breakthrough was when they were able to lay multiple numbers of eggs and started outpacing the nautiluses with just sheer numbers. And here's another interesting thing too that happens when you have a lot of offspring and individuals is that increases the mixing in the gene pool, increases the chances for mutations to happen. So what we have, I think, when we look at the ammonites here, and especially when we can use these here in the Western Interior Seaway, Ken, is we can see this rapid evolution happening with these by the suture, how the sutures form in these animals, how many fossils we can find them. Sometimes there's hundreds of these shells laying in areas. And you never find nautilus fossils like that. You might find nautiloid fossils back from the Ordovician, really thick and layered. I found, dozens of those in a layer. But you don't see that
right. Pretty
much, that many, individuals until you start getting into the ammonites. And that's where we start seeing the multiple ammonites. And I believe that's what the breakthrough was on this animal. It was the ability to lay multiple numbers of eggs.
Right. Well, with all the vast numbers of ammonites comparatively, there must have been something eating them, What would have been preying on the Ammonites back then, Ken?
Well, there have been several critters, actually, Ken. When we start looking at some of the animals that probably ate the Ammonites, I think we have to look at some of the mosasaurs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we look at mosasaurs. I also think we look at some of the ichthyosaurs. They were probably, some of those probably fed on Ammonites. Probably some of the, plesiosaurs also probably fed on these Ammonites, you know. So there were several creatures. We do see Ammonite fossils, this is interesting, that do have show teeth marks in them. So we do know, you know, there was something out there preying on. And teeth marks sometimes match up to some of the different plesiosaur types. One of the plesiosaurs that was big with big jaws, although it got the size of a crocodile, and that was Kronosaurus. This one here, actually you find it further south. It didn't live in the North American Western Tierra Seaway. I guess we want to talk about a creature like that. We might look at the Pleioplatocarpus,
mm-hmm.
although that's a mosasaur.
Have you heard of any ammonite or any other cephalopod, actually, from this period, actually found with a tooth in it?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? It's like
off
tooth.
Lost. You know what, Ken? That's a very interesting question, I do not have the answer to that, actually. Although I do know they have teeth marks. Now, here's the interesting thing, too, though. When we look in some of these deposits here in the Western Interior Seaway, we do find teeth of plesiosaurs, mosasaurs, and some of these other animals. We do find their teeth. Matter of fact, I think here in New Mexico, some of the only evidence that we have of some of these plesiosaurs and mosasaurs have been their teeth.
Mm-hmm. Got another question here from the chat room for you, Ken.
Okay.
Wouldn't a mosasaur chop off a plesiosaur head with one bite to the neck?
You know,
depending on the size of the plesiosaur and the mosasaur, of course, but like a full-grown adult mosasaur and, I don't know, or any size plesiosaur, actually, it should be able to fight through it, wouldn't it?
At least break it in pieces. Yeah, I imagine it probably could. You know, I know there's been evidence of these animals preying on each other out there in the Western Interior Seaway. We find teeth marks and stuff, but I'm wondering, you know, also, it's just like some of the animals we see living today, you know, were there ecological niches, you know, where certain animals just lived, they didn't really intermix with each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, so much because their niches were different,
maybe,
you know.
Maybe one was a deeper water inhabitant and one was a shallows inhabitant, comparatively. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
something like that.
That's
there.
What I'm thinking, you know. Because this is kind of interesting because I think we find, actually, when we start looking for some of these marine animals, we see more of them from along the eastern part of the seaway. But here's the kind of interesting thing, too, is we was talking about, you know, the Manco Shell. The Manco Shell is older than the famous Niobrara Chalk. Now, the Niobrara Chalk is where we see a lot of these animals being found in. And it's the Cretaceous, of course, is named for the chalk. And I think it was
mm-hmm.
named for the White Cliffs of Dover, I believe, Ken.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the chalk deposits there. And, of course, the Niobrara Chalk, I believe, was also part of that of the time when the animals that made the chalk. See, there was forams and diatoms and other minute creatures that made their shells out of silica. And they were really abundant in the seaway during this particular point in time. Now, there's a lot of sea life really going on, too. A lot of fish. I believe there was something like 70 different species of fish that had been found, you know, and probably a whole lot more. And because we're only looking at, once again, small sections. That's what's so kind of crazy about paleontology, Ken, is like we say, we got the Book of Life, and basically it's been ripped to pieces and scattered around, you know, chunks of it and stuff. And sometimes mm-hmm. we'll find a chapter or two kind of chunked together, you know, and other times we're finding one little page. And when we're, like here in New Mexico, you know, we're seeing a series of the chapter where it's kind of thick because we can go, we have all the way, almost the complete interior seaway deposits here in New Mexico. And so we see different forms of life, you know. With, like I said, we'll see some of the bigger fossils of the bigger animals on the eastern side, where here on the western side, we're more prone to find teeth, shark teeth especially. Now, this is kind of cool, too. The shark life that was living in the western interior seaway, Ken, was absolutely amazing. There were a lot of different species.
Wow.
And
so they must have been preying on something. There must have been a lot of food for them there.
Well, the Western Interior Seaway was full of fish too. There was it. It
right.
was really the upper parts. You know, they it was fairly oxygen rich in the upper parts. And like I said, we find all kinds of species. One of my favorite of the fishes, and this here comes from the Niobrara chalk area, was a fish. It's now called Ziphactinus. Are you familiar with that one or not?
No. What can you tell us about that one, Ken?
Well, many years ago, and I'm sure you might remember these books, but do you remember the old Time Life books?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember the one on fossils. And in it, it showed a picture of some paleontologists with this big, like 20-foot-long, 6-meter-long fossil fish there. They were kind of standing, you know, across the top of it. And I believe at the time it was called a Portheus. Now, why is it called Ziphactinus now? Well, we'll take a little side break here and explain that reason why. It's because the original description of this particular fish was actually named Ziphactinus. And a lot of times in naming fossils and stuff, another paleontologist will come along and not realize that the animal that he is describing has already been named, which was the case of Portheus. So it falls back to its original name. That's how scientific names work, which was Ziphactinus. And that is why we now know the fish that was called Portheus, Ziphactinus. But the interesting thing it showed about this particular Ziphactinus, Ken, was that it had a 2-meter-long fossil fish inside its rib cage.
Oh, I've seen that one.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that was Ziphactinus.
Yeah, and a big old 6.5-foot long fish.
I know which one you mean now. It was a great long fish, wasn't it? It was a huge fish.
Huge fish, yeah. They get up to about, 6 meters in some of the biggest ones. So
wow.
It was a big predator, fish eater, of course, and it ate big fish. You know, it's funny. When I was growing up back in Indiana, my dad and I, we used to go fishing a lot, and my dad had a thing, you know, if you want to catch a big fish, you got to use a big bait. So I guess you want to go after some of these big monster fishes, you know, it probably wouldn't hurt to hook you about a 5-foot fish on there as bait, would it?
Right.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's right. That's the thing.
But one of the cool things I like about Ziphactinus, too, I believe it is one of the bony tongues, too.
Just related
to the arowana.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this was saltwater fish because the seaway was saltwater, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's definitely marine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to talk a little bit about the seabed real quick.
Right.
When we do look at the shallow parts of the seaway, like along the beach sands, Ken, we find all kinds of really great stuff. We get all kinds of mollusks. We have echinoids like starfish like Temnosideros. We find all kinds of we also find washed up the back ammonite shells, different mollusk shells such as oysters. What's one of the big ones? that lived in, I think, Sennomeris, I think, was one of the big shell mollusk bivalves that lived in the Western Interior Seaway. But you know, we have a lot of really interesting organisms that were living along the beach and shores, and we find a lot of their fossil stuff here in New Mexico along the beach sands. They'll be full, just full of beautiful, beautifully preserved shells.
Well, that'll be a great place to go collecting. And being a mollusk or whatever, you can't pick them up then.
What's that?
Being a mollusk, you can collect them.
Yes, you can. You collect ammonites too, which is really killer, you know.
Yeah. If it's bone, though, you can't collect that, right?
Yeah, usually when it comes to collecting bone, for our listeners out there collecting fossils, it's always good to be sure and look up your state's rules. But here in New Mexico and a lot of different places, bone fossils, especially if they're on federal or state lands, are definite hands-off. You cannot touch them. Not even touch them. You can't pick them up. Even under some of the, although I'm covered by the museum collecting permits, if the area does not have a permit covering it, I cannot collect bone fossils myself even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to leave
them. If you do come across, what you do, I guess, is take a GPS recording and take a photo if you've got your camera there or your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And go to the museum and let them know.
Yep. Well, with me, that's what we do. We turn the site in. And then we ask Dr. Lucas to apply for a permit from the appropriate government agency. And usually we can get permits to collect just about anywhere. Now, private property, fossils on that property, bone fossils, belong to the landowner. Always remember that, too, or whoever collects. So you have to get permission from them. And that's a little bit easier to get permission to collect bone fossils from a landowner. And usually,
right.
If you're really a nice person and you respect the landowners, they'll let you collect fossils for the most part. I get along real good with landowners. I guess, growing up in a farm country back east, it's easy to talk with a lot of the ranchers out here in New Mexico and let them know, it's like, yeah, I understand agriculture, so we respect
mm-hmm.
What you do. And got access to over 500,000 acres of Permian research area.
Excellent.
Yeah,
great
cool.
Advice for our listeners.
Yeah, definitely say please and thank you and may I.
And don't spoil it for yourself or for other people who want to go collecting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just good and respect the property of the person, you know, pack in, pack out, et cetera, et cetera. And but it's a good, it's a good way to go out and enjoy nature, because that's one of the things I like doing is get out and explore. And some of the places we've went to here that of the different parts of the Inland Sea, Ken, I've actually explored quite a number of areas here. One of the interesting spots that we've explored is considered a storm surge because the area where it occurs is a little bit offshore. From Laramidia,
mm-hmm.
and it is full of shark teeth. And
wow.
What's really interesting about this particular layer of sandstone, because the sandstone layers are fairly thin, and we see them scattered occasionally throughout the Manco Shale, but they don't cover large areas. They only cover small areas. And it's in those areas that we'll find shark teeth that get washed up and sorted by the currents, et cetera, because the currents, that's how we know it also these beach sands where they are, because we see the how the currents have sorted the shells and things like that. And so we do, you can see that in this, in the these different sandstone layers.
Wow. Ken, have you ever looked at any sand from the Cretaceous that would have been from the seaway?
Absolutely.
Yeah, through your microscope. Through your microscope, I mean, yeah.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, that would be interesting, I would think. Would you agree?
It's got lots of little animals, little shells and things in it, small things like that you can't see, little fish teeth, things like that, So it's very interesting, as I mentioned, these storm surge areas. one of the little storm surges that we collected from. I found my first shark tooth in it a couple years ago. We happened to we stopped there several years ago, and we collected ammonites. And the ammonites we collected there were doggone, I can't think of their genus name at the moment, but it was one of the streamlined species, the flattened shells without any ornamentation. And now these were basically sandstone steinkerns. They weren't some of the beautiful ammonites that we've seen preserved. But we'd been looking through the sandstone that they were in for, we found, you know, a lot of different shells. There was a different oyster type shells. Some of the doggone, the scallop type shells living in it.
Right.
We saw the different those, but one of the cool things I found was one of the long, narrow fish eating type shark teeth.
Ah, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, I wish the shark teeth were a little bit thicker in it, but this now a few miles away from that particular area, not very far, just a few miles at another spot in that sandstone, it's weathering apart really rapidly. And it is full with dozens of small, tiny shark teeth in it. Now, this is what's cool, Ken. It's like going down to a modern beach and picking these things up right out of the sand.
Wow. Sounds like a great collecting area.
Oh, it is. Yeah, if you get a chance to come out here, that's one of the places we'll have to take you to, let you can do some shark collecting. Because, like I said, they're really cool. Now, that's where you find this stuff. You don't find a lot of these kind of fossils in the shales and stuff such as the Mancos or anything like that. The one thing about the Niobrara chalk, as I mentioned there, it's on along the western part of Appalachia. And once again, we're in the shallower seas, shallower inland area, and that's where we're seeing some of the, you know, a lot of the fish fossils. Now, also, when we look at the Niobrara. Now, the Niobrara is several million years younger than the Mancos shale. I believe the Mancos, let me see here, I just had my, there we go. The Mancos shale, I believe, covered the Cenomanian-Turonian, Carnosinian age. And I believe when we start getting up towards the Companion, the Santonian and the Companion, we start getting into the Niobraran age. And the chalky part. And we see the preservation of a lot of really nice animals and stuff. I mean, all kinds of stuff was preserved. One of the interesting creatures that I would like to find from that area is one of my favorite animals, Ken, and that's the animal called Pteranodon, one of the pterosaurs.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they find fossils actually quite often, I guess. You know, you'll find pieces of fossils of Pteranodon. Appears to be a fish eater. Grew to about 1.8 meters in length. I think it had, about a 6-meter wingspan or something like that, I believe. About 20, 24 feet long wingspan, 6 to 7 meters. And it probably, you know, you see them gliding over the Western Sea, you know, kind of like albatross do today.
Wow, that would have been a sight, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Now, there was another pterosaur that we find fossils of here in New Mexico and also down around Western Texas, the Big Bend area. Now, the Big Bend area of Texas was fully underwater. The particular ones we found here in New Mexico appear to have been right on just inside the coastline. But they were probably a coastal animal, and also they probably glided back and forth across the seaway. And that's a pterosaur called Quetzalcoatlus.
What's that one, Ken?
This, Ken, I think would be an animal that would probably scare the bejeebies out of you if you come walking upon it in an area. It was a pterosaur that had a wingspan, one of the largest wingspans of any living animal, over 12 meters. Ken, I used to fly airplanes, little Cessna 150s, that had a wingspan not quite as wide as this animal.
Wow. So who would have taken down your plane?
Oh, yeah. Well, this would have been the animal that you'd want to have a pet to ride on, you know. But they were about the, their head height was about the height of a giraffe, modern giraffe. So that's what you'd have seen come, you know, with his big wings, you know. They walked on all fours. That's an interesting thing about pterosaurs. They weren't bipedal. They actually were quadrupedal. So,
oh, right. They kind of walked on their wrists or elbows or something, didn't they?
Yeah, well, the knuckles. I think they were kind of like maybe knuckle walkers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's, I find that fascinating. But Quetzalcoatlus, you know, one of the largest of the pterosaurs. You know, you can find fossils of them along the Western Interior Seaway. Now, one of the animals that you don't hear about, now I find also fascinating, that lived in here in the Western Interior Seaway, Ken, was some of the birds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, birds as well. What kind of birds were there around there then, Ken?
Well, I can think of a couple. See if I can find my notes here that shows the two birds I want to talk about here. But I know one was Ichthyornis, I believe. And I think Ichthyornis was one of the fish eating. And I think there was a Hesperornis. I'm hoping I'm right. I could be mistaken. But,
Hesperornis, I think we've talked about before. That had virtually no wings, didn't it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, Hesperornis and Ichthyornis. I think we have talked about them in the past. And now, the interesting thing about we definitely have talked about Hesperornis here, but we got to mention it here. They grew to about a meter tall. You know, they kind of resemble, I think, kind of like a Cretaceous period penguin.
That's from the diagrams I've seen of them, that's a pretty good description. I think the wings were even smaller than current day penguins, relatively, aren't they?
From what I can see of a skeleton here, I've got a photograph of a skeleton in front of me. The wings were tiny. Yeah, very smaller than the penguins. They probably couldn't use their wings at all for anything. Just use their large web feet.
Right.
And
Yeah, they were a very, very interesting creature.
Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about it as a bird, had teeth.
Yeah. Wow.
And, teeth in its beak. And when we look at Ichthyornis, which is another bird we find in fossils of in the Western Interior Seaway, was also has teeth in its beak. Now, one of the cool things...
I wonder if that's something you could turn on.
That's a very good question. I think a few years ago I was watching an interesting program on genetics, and they were talking about retroversing a bird. And they did some interesting experiments with the Hox genes. We've talked about Hox genes a lot on this show, you know,
yep.
How they get turned on and off. And basically that's what we're looking at here when we look at a toothless bird. We're looking at a dinosaur that certain Hox genes have been turned off on it because they were able to take the chemicals to stimulate Hox genes and
mm-hmm.
actually apply it to the embryos in places on the chicken, like on the beaks. They also applied some to the tail area, and they were able to get the Hox genes to turn on where they were actually growing tail vertebrae and also were showing where the teeth development was happening in the beaks.
Wow. So it's just, it doesn't take very much to do that, actually.
Yeah. Just
the right circumstances.
Yeah. Turning on the genes or turning them off, and that's what happens a lot of times in evolution, you know. It's just a matter of... it's kind of like almost a binary code that has the universal code of DNA thrown in, you know? You got the on or off on the Hox genes, you know, that help control these different things. And a lot of times when a Hox gene is turned off, it's turned off for good. You know, it's like a one-way switch on these things.
Wow, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
How many actually ancient birds do turn up with teeth? Like all the ones they're finding over in China now.
It's
interesting to see.
I still think they'll take an emu embryo and do that same thing that they did with the chicken embryos, because it's an old lineage.
Capillary.
Yeah. Yeah, or cassowary, but one of those primitive-type birds, you know. And see how much they can retrofit one of those things. But at any rate, there's a number of different species of birds that can be found in the Western COA fossils as well. So overall, when we're looking at the life there, Ken, I think we're looking at just one of the most, you know, a dynamic sea aquatic system.
Yeah, it sounds like it was like there was life everywhere.
Yeah.
At the time. So one of those rich times for life on the Earth.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because actually it was. It was a time of global warming. You know, it's one of the things about being a paleontologist all these years, and I look through the rock record and studying geology, and mm-hmm. you see the low stands and the high stands of the seas. You see the glaciations that happen. You see where the continents have moved around. You know, you see where they've crashed together and they've pulled apart and they crashed together again. We see all this evidence, and in the fossil record we see extinctions and stuff, but one of the things that we've found is really interesting about the Cretaceous is the amount of life and diversity. You know, it was a very rich time for life. Plant life, it was grown from top to bottom, and, we still had cold winters, but the sea never, I don't think the Northern Sea ever froze. You know, because there was so much water circulation from the poles, or from the equator, I mean.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're seeing, the temperatures were moderate, even a lot further north than you would, expect today. Today, we've got the Isthmus of Panama, that rose several million years ago, and that stopped the currents from flowing, from the Atlantic to the Pacific there. So that cut those off several million years ago, and we've got the circulation systems that are set up like with the Gulf Current, in the Atlantic, and of course the currents are going through the Pacific. So this all changes around, and life is once again, we have our modern life that has evolved in these separate basins like that.
Excellent. Oh, anything else you could? Any other animals that were around then, Ken? I think we've covered
about all the big animals that were living there. As far as I know, there were no dinosaurs that were living in the Seaway. It was all these other groups of animals.
Plesiosaurs, mosasaurs, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these animals aren't dinosaurs. They're other things. I guess closest to a dinosaur would be in the birds, huh?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one thing we've got to talk about here real quick, though, is the land masses on the different areas. I don't believe... now, we have Tyrannosaur-type relatives that live there in Appalachia, but I don't believe that we have the T-Rexes like we see here in... New Mexico and some of these other areas, that lived along the Western Interior Seaway. As the seaways wax and wane, that's how we're seeing in some places like Montana and different places, we're seeing T-Rexes and things. That's because they were able to move out further as the seaways transgressed and regressed, because mm-hmm. they did that several times. They moved back and forth. It wasn't a consistent seaway for the Upper Cretaceous. It had its wax and wanes. So we see this in the life and the fossils that we find. But I think one of the cool things to do is if you're – now. Well, before we get to the cool thing to do.
Right.
It's kind of funny here in the West and Southwest how much Cretaceous land deposits are available for us to hunt fossils in. And when I lived back east, you had to go almost along the coast to find anything, the Atlantic coast, to find anything that was Cretaceous or thereabouts, because this central area like Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, up where you're at, that for the most part was above sea level most of the time, and it was an erosional surface. So we don't get as many dinosaurs. You'll find dinosaur fossils washed into the shallower areas along the seaway itself. And we sometimes find dinosaurs in the deposits here along the Western Seaboard that have been washed out into it. They didn't live there. They were just, carcasses, et cetera, that died. And
walked down the rivers and flushed into the system, more or less.
Mm-hmm. So we see that. But there's different dinosaurs in Laramidia and Appalachia. You know, they're close related, but they're still different because the seaway cut them off and allowed each one to develop its own set of dinosaurs. Now, when the seaway started retreating, that was in the Paleogene, the earliest part of the Paleogene. And then we started having glaciations happening. The seaways I believe the continental seafloor spreading, the seafloor spreading slowed down a little bit, and that allowed some of the water to drain off. So the continents lost the western interior seaway. And from most of the Paleogene on, we see the land changing into what we see today, with only minor incursions of the seas over the last 60 million years. And that's pretty much that.
And then the animals that developed in the west and the animals that developed in the east were mixed. But by that stage, they had speciated enough to be different species, I guess.
Well, here's what's interesting, is about the time the Western Interior Seaway started disappearing, that's when we had the Chicxulub meteor hit.
Of course.
Yeah. And I would imagine if there had been a seaway part there, stuff, it probably was a site of a massive tsunami, you know, as the meteor, hit the Yucatan Peninsula and part of the Gulf of Mexico. It would have been devastating.
That snuffed out all that great proliferation of life that happened in this time that we're talking about, I guess. KT.
Well, from about 100 million plus years to about 65 million years ago, you know, the Western Interior Seaway of the Cretaceous was an awesome place to be. But then, like I said, after the seaway drained, now we have what we see today. 65 million years later, our topography. And we only have just the fossils to show us what once was there.
But still, at least we have where you are, where I am. As you said, it was an erosional surface, so there's nothing there. Let alone the fact that there was the glaciation afterwards, too, in the Ice Ages.
But, living here in a depositional, this was called the depositional area, because we had the buildup of it. If any of our listeners out there are ever here in New Mexico, you can contact me if you can, and I'd be happy to help take you out to some of the places here in the Mancos Shale and help you collect some ammonite fossils and maybe some other things. I do like to mention something real cool here about one of the ammonite species, Ken, that lived here in the Western Interior Seaway. You ready for the size of this one particular type grew?
What's that?
Approximately 3 meters in diameter.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Have you ever found anything anywhere approaching that size, Ken?
No. My brother come across the one out in the middle of nowhere one time, but he's not been able to find it again. I've seen there's a I think it's the Natural History Museum at Berlin, Germany. I think that's where it's at. And my brother went and visited there one time when he was in stationed in the military. And they had a New Mexico ammonite almost 9 feet in diameter outside the museum for people to look at.
Right.
And he got a picture of it. Yeah.
I've seen pictures of big ones from England. I never realized there was big ones in your area, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's really interesting, to go to the area to find one of those right now, for me, is probably about an hour drive from where I live, as just a little bit to the north and east as we move a little bit around the shoreline, and I can find those giant ammonites.
Have you got any in your museum?
No, I'm sure we do have them in the back room. There are a few on display. But the museum itself has a very nice collection of ammonites from all over the New Mexico of the western interior. So from the beginning of it till it finally closed out. If you get a chance to come out and visit, I'll have to take you into the Holy of Holies of the museum and let you see some of the stuff we have back there.
There's nothing like a back room, is there?
Oh, there's nothing like it, you know, and knowing that I have free rein to go back there and look and study and be awed by what's there, you know, and get to see a lot of these fossils that the general public has, you know, doesn't get to see. I get to see brand new discoveries. That's been something that's been fantastic before they're even being studied. Just so with this one massive shark that come out of the Kenny Quarry, upper Carboniferous shark, and it's the best preserved fossil shark in the world ever. Complete fossil shark. They usually deteriorate to just pieces. This thing is complete, head to tail, brain cage, brain. Yeah, it's got it all. Cartilage, and it fell into a lager stat, and it got buried. Decompose before it got completely buried, and we have this special fossil. So that's what's cool about going into the back room and being able to do that at the museum. So it's a lot of fun. But for those of our listeners out there, there's quite a bit of exposure of the Western Interior Seaway. If you're really into fossil collecting and you come out to the west, definitely go and check out parts of it. You can collect invertebrate fossils without worrying too much about laws. If you are on private property, please get permission, of course. But come out and check out the Seaway. It's got some amazing stuff, and I think they'll really enjoy it.
So I guess if you're collecting the Seaway, you could start in, or even down as far as Mexico, I guess, and go all up through Montana, through BC, just on the eastern slopes of the Rockies.
Yes,
I guess roughly.
Yeah, all the way up to the Arctic.
Wow.
Yeah, all the way up. It completely cut the continent in pieces. So, but the life in it is fantastic. You know, the fossils and stuff, and you don't know what you're going to find. You know, so come out and look for mosasaurs, look for plesiosaurs, look for pterosaurs. You know, it's to me, fossil hunting is one of the fun. I'd rather do fossil hunting than play go to a casino.
Right.
To me, the win is much.
I think even I could find an ammonite if it was 9 foot diameter.
Well,
a 9 foot one. Even I would see that, I think.
No, we'd figure out a way to roll it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ken, I think that's a pretty nice little trip to the Seaway. We're going to give
Excellent.
Mary a break here. She's got to get up real early in the morning here. But next week on the Fine Art of Paleontology, you and I are going to talk about something. We're going to do a little geology, Ken.
What's that, Ken? What are we going to do next week?
You know, one of the most frequently asked questions I get, I think almost everybody asks me this here, is why are there seashells on mountaintops?
All right.
So I want to go and talk about the geology of why there are seashells on top of mountains. And it's not some mystical, magical, mean old, mad old deity that's trying to wipe out people. It's tectonic forces and the power of the earth and what's under our feet, you know. So I think that's really amazing, you know. We're so tiny. And that these forces appear so big to us, you know. But when you look at the size of the planet and you look at the forces that make mountains, mountains are little teeny tiny things on the crust, you know. They're not very big at all. So when you look at the overall picture of it, it's like, oh, it's easy for this Earth to make mountains.
Yeah, well, I guess it's not the seashells we're talking about either, is it? It's basically tectonic uplifts,
mm-hmm.
and everything that can be found. Like you can get aquatic animals appearing in deserts and things like that.
Exactly. You know, it's all about tectonics. So we'll take a little journey next week into geology and explain some of the things that, things us paleontologists use to help us understand, you know, why the fossils we hunt for are where they are. So join us next time on for that there. I think it'll be a fun show.
I think it'll be great. Now I'd like to invite all our listeners, too, if you've got any questions, go into the chat room. It's open. It's not just open when we do the shows. It's open 24 hours, 7 days a week. Ask a question there. I might not be there at the time, but I'll certainly see it, and we'll ask it at any future show that comes up.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you have an idea that you'd like Ken and me to do on a show, please let us know. We're always happy to look up different things in paleontology and geology and bring it to you, because the Earth is a fascinating thing. And the rocks tell a fascinating story. They tell the true story of the life on Earth here. So we want to ask you to join us for next time for that there. I want to do a real quick announcement here for our listeners here.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. then we'll wish them good night and let Mary get to bed. We do want to mention that you can, as Ken said, you can go to Nature's Talk Show on our website and follow us on our live chat. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. If you go to Face, or you can follow us on Blog Talk as well. We have a like button there that you should click and check. We have a PayPal button on our website if you want to help donate money to Nature's Talk Show to keep us these fun shows. Check out and sign up for our newsletter on our website. Visit our store for all kinds of cool stuff. As we mentioned, visit our chat room. Check out our archive shows. And that's all the cool stuff we have going on at the minute here. Ken, thank you once again for an awesome time.
Thank you, Ken. It's always a pleasure doing these shows with you. And I learn so much from them, and I hope our listeners do too.
They're a lot of fun, aren't they? Well, what's fun, too, is I get to go back and review and learn more, too, myself. And that's one thing. You never get too old to learn, and I love learning new stuff all the time myself.
Yeah, never too old to learn.
Nope. All right. Well, with that there, I want to thank our listeners, thank our friend in the chat room for joining us and asking us questions as well. And we'll see you here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Everybody have a good evening and stay warm. Bye-bye.
Good night. Good night from me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.